what we end up doing is going into a particular energy that's comforting. What you do when you go into that is that, I know it seems kind of strange, but it's a subtle form of violence to ourselves to avoid truth, if that makes sense. When you meditate, when you close your eyes, there's a lot of things that you're trying to, there's a lot of things that you could be trying to achieve in meditation. The first one is to become familiar with what's going on in your head, just to familiarize yourself with your inclinations. Another thing that you could do when you close your eyes and you're sitting is you could be doing work with your breath, becoming more familiar with breath work. Another common thing is that when we do meditation, we try to come into contact with subtle energies, so prana or chi, and then we try to direct that energy. I think for the purpose of this group, everyone has to do a little bit of everything. And I say that because everyone is dealing with pain on some level, and learning how to deal with the mind and learning how to make contact with energy is one way to learn how to deal with pain. And it's hard to kind of make those leaps without consistent practice. So the important thing is that whatever you're learning, you take it and you train it, just like an athlete would train one range of motion, like a football player will take, you know, pushing with the hands to, like if you're a lineman or something, you would take this technique of manipulating someone's hips to push them off the line, and you would train it 100 to 1,000 times, just trying to get that little action to happen. And so that it becomes habitual, that it becomes a second nature. And you basically have to do the same thing with the mind, and this is why I think working with the physical terrain or the physical dimension of it is important, because you have to see that it's a very real practice what you're doing inside here. And you want to treat it like you're trying to create muscle memory, but you're trying to create mental habit. Now often, I don't know where everyone is in their meditation, but a lot of times when you're doing meditation, the instruction, the most common thing is to work with the breath. And the reason why we work with the breath is because it's constant. You know, if you try to work with an image, which is one way to work, the image floats. If you're thinking about keeping a purple ball in front of your eyes, as soon as you think purple ball, it turns into a green triangle. Does that make sense? And so the breath, however, doesn't change that much. Now, there's subtleties within the breath. When you can't escape the breath, it's always going to be there. There's going to be a rise and a fall, and there's going to be a filling up and a releasing, and there's going to be a sound the whole time. And that's why the breath is the most common. There's also mantras. You could say things, which I think is probably a little bit better than visualization. Just depends on your own inclination. There's prayers, which is a mantra. There's, so those kind of things happen. And even the sound of the chimes when Ursula rings those chimes is, even though a lot of times when you do it, like the way she uses it is at the end of the meditation to kind of bring you back to this plane, you could actually use the sound of the chime as a means for meditation, just the sound itself, following the sound to its most finite conclusion. You know, and it rings for a lot longer than we allow it to ring. And if you really follow the sound, what it does is it takes you inward. It goes from a gross sound to a more subtle sound. And that's the fundamental thing that happens in all of meditation practices, is learning to recognize the gross and then moving it to the subtle. Right. And I think what we're going to do today is similar to what we did last week, which is using the posture as a means for maintaining our presence of mind. But I think I might talk a little bit about fear or fearlessness or something like that as well. Now, if you're, and some of you will know what I'm saying, if you're trying to meditate by becoming, like if your focus, does everyone know what they're doing when they're meditating? I mean, do you have a clear goal, or is it just kind of, you know, wait to hear what the teacher has to say and then just follow that? Does everyone have a meditation practice outside of this class?
Say that again.
Does everyone have a meditation practice outside of this class? I mean, do you do some of this stuff on your own?
Yeah, I do.
You do?
I do.
And does every, what is, if you, you don't have to say anything, but if anyone wants to chime in, what do you focus on when you're meditating? I mean, what is it, do you have a goal? Do you have maybe a benchmark in mind?
Well, me personally, I have a goal. In dealing with pain, my goal is to respect my pain, which I do. Mm-hmm. And as I move along my path, you know, I try and keep it cultivated, similar to what you were saying with the football player, mm-hmm. whatnot. But my goal has become to distinguish, like, pain related with discomfort at the same time. You know, whether the pain is a, you know, a real type pain or the pain of where it just give me discomfort, which I think all of us kind of deal with. But my goal and my path is to be able to neutralize the pain in a sense and just move forward and realizing and respecting that it's there, gonna be there, but to be able to mentally control it. That's my goal.
Is that like 90% in you?
What are some other thoughts or examples? We have to go in more than that. What are we doing?
I started doing meditation about a year and a half ago. I did it for about 8 months, and I could tell that it was benefiting me. But there was a part that I didn't understand why there was something that was missing that I was, knew that there was something missing, but I didn't know what it was. And back in last April, I kind of stopped practicing meditation, and I stopped doing it at my house. And I started reading the Bible and just focused on that. Well, last Friday, I kind of brought the two together. Just last Friday, I was listening to music, and Ursula's CD is on, mixed in with my tape on it on shuffle, and it came up with the introduction for her CD. And as I'm listening to it, everything, just about everything that was said in that introduction, my mind went to God. And I think it went there from a verse that everybody knows from church, "Be still and know that I am God." And in my past, it's always, I just hear it and it doesn't really hit me or affect me. Well, since April, I'm reading the Bible, I keep thinking about that verse and the way it was brought to me. It said, "Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still, be." And everything you change that verse, it's got a little bit of a different meaning. And so now when I think about I am, God's name is I am the creator. I am healer. I am comforter. I am the way. I am the sculptor. You are the clay. And he's sculpting me to be who I am. And so this, now I want to start doing this meditation again and bring in both things and see where this journey takes me. And like right now, today, I feel things that I haven't felt from the, when I was doing it before. And I guess it's just because I haven't been doing it. it wasn't comfortable, and I felt the tenseness in my neck again, like my eyes started tearing, and I don't know why, but I just feel like it's going to be another process to bring the two together.
So you were saying that you started going back into discomfort?
Yeah, because I really haven't done this since April.
Okay. Meditation. Okay. And just tell me again what happened when you first started meditating again.
When I first started meditation a year and a half ago, it was a process where I didn't notice my feelings or uneasiness, but then it did get easier, and it would bring me calm and peace and stillness after meditation, but it was a process for me to get there. And then when I kind of felt like, well, I don't really understand what I was doing. There were times where I know I've listened to the same exercise many, many times, and then one time I'm doing it, and I felt like I had never heard it before, and I know I have, and it kind of bothered me. I'm like, okay, so what am I doing in meditation? So that's kind of why I stopped. But now I can see, bring my awareness to my body and my creator, and let me be, and just bring the calmness that I gain in not just in meditation, but every moment of the day.
Okay. And what's your name?
Susan.
Ann.
Oh, Ann.
Yeah,
okay. anyone else?
Well, I know that myself, prior to me coming to meditation, I suffered with a lot of chronic pain. And since I came on Dr. Click, dealing with the meditation, it kind of helped me relax. Like you were saying, you deal with the discomfort of your pain more when you meditate, because it relaxes your body. And you don't feel, you know the pain is there, but you want to go on with your everyday life. You don't want to let the pain control you. You want to control the pain. So that's how I deal with it. I know my pain is there, but I don't focus on my pain. I try to go beyond my pain, you know. But then sometimes it hits me, that pain that's kind of like attacking me at one time of another, to then I focus back on that meditation. And so that eases me. That's what keeps me going. It keeps me relaxed and motivated more. So it helps me out a lot, a whole lot.
Well, they really said it all in a nutshell, but all I can contribute to this, as I have mentioned to Dr. Klitsch when I first started coming here, is unfortunately I was a part of another group through workers' comp, and that doctor, there was no organization, no structure, and I went there for almost 3 years. And in that period of time, I didn't learn anything. There was nothing, nothing. And coming here that very first time, I realized that this is obviously different, because the workers' comp said I was coming here. I'm thinking, okay, here we go again. But of course, that very first day when she was doing all the things on the board, so that was good. But then prior to coming here, I really wasn't placing my pain, or I like that, bucketizing the pain. I learned that from a program on TV. So I didn't know where to put it, and I'm obviously was putting it in the wrong bucket, and now I have the right spot to put it, and by her coordinating you with this, Now it's all coming together when you throw God, I'm a Christian, so yes. And so when you can combine all of that, that's great. So kudos to her and to you.
Okay. All right. So thanks for sharing. And I'll try to touch on a couple of those things. One of the things that is often not mentioned in yoga, at least in the type of yoga that I teach, which is often asana practice and not as much meditation, my meditation students are kind of special. In the yoga world, as we commonly know it, it's often physical, and so not a lot of people go there for the internal aspects of it. They often go for stretching and so on and so forth. But one thing that's really interesting that you brought, is it Anne? is God, and then the way to, one of the things that's really hard to explain to people, because God is such a loaded word, that in the yoga method, one of the things that you do in your yamas and your niyamas, are sort of like your 10 commandments, and they're considered internal purification and then ways of being in the world. And your internal purifications are things like don't have greed in your heart, don't covet. And then one of those things is also study scriptures, if you will, whether they be the Bible or other evolved beings' take on reality. And then there's the ways to act out in the world, which is don't steal, don't kill, things like that. It's basically the same idea. So yoga practice begins with the same concepts, which is, you know, the golden rule, and, you know, learn how to live with one another and learn how to live within yourself. And so that's kind of a hard subject to touch on in the gym world, because most people are like, well, when do I get to stretch my hamstrings? You know, that's like what's in their head. And I think it's hard, and in the yoga way of dealing with God is one after, and this is, you know, it's, everyone has their own interpretation of what God means. But no matter how you interpret it, the fact is that in the yoga, in the Ashtanga practice, which is the eightfold practice of self-cultivation and mindfulness, is at the end of it all, at the end of the day, you've done your body cleansing, you've done your mental cleansing, you've done your emotional cleansing, you've gone out and done your work for the day. At the end of the day, you still have to dedicate everything you do to God. Right? So you can take that as you like it, but I'm just saying that this is part of the practice, is dedicating your efforts to something beyond yourself. Because the reality is that we don't, we cannot have our efforts be selfish. And because it's, you know, it really leads you down a dead end to dedicate your efforts to your own identity. Because as we know, we're going to pass on at some point. And whatever we build, everything that we build up around ourselves is related to our moments in life. But once it comes to an end, we might, if we're lucky, be like a paragraph in a history book. You with me? So what we do is we give our energy back to nature, to God, to the universe on some level. And this doesn't even have to be very esoteric. The truth is, if you've ever lived with someone who does not clean up the house, but you're constantly cleaning up the house, like, you know that there's not an equal exchange of energy. Someone is not giving back to the relationship that you have. You're sharing a space together, and you're not giving the energy back to the space. Even though the space doesn't really exist without you, you're still giving into the space. And this is kind of, in the yoga world, what God how we represent God is we're giving energy back out to the world. You can't take, because you don't really keep. Whether you're conscious of it or not, what you take in still goes out. We harbor notions of grandeur, of identity, but the identity doesn't exist except for within our own egos and our minds. So that's an interesting point, that the God thing. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I don't ever get to talk about God in the yoga world, because you just don't want to touch that. It's like politics, you know. So if you are inclined towards that, it's important to recognize no matter what you're doing for yourself, you're still dedicating it outward to some energy beyond yourself. Right? And this is actually really helpful in dealing with pain, because in my opinion, one of my favorite quotes is "Trust your struggle." I think I mentioned this last week. Because if you're relating it to God, God provides you with whatever it is you need to learn yoga lessons, if you will. And I think the nature, especially now when we get into meditating, a lot of times what you have to deal with first is coming to a place of neutrality so that you can start channeling your energy into positive means. And neutrality means it may take like 5 lifetimes to even get to a point of neutrality. And neutrality means not putting, not making yourself raw by clinging to things that don't really exist. So if you've ever been and had an emotional experience where someone did something to you and then you're just totally raw about it the whole day, or maybe even a week or a month, you're just thinking about, oh, I can't believe they did that to me. You know, they don't have the right to do these kind of things to me, and blah, blah, blah. And what we do in our head is similar to that, but we do it on a much milder level and a more insidious way. And like I started talking about, which is it's getting into that, is kind of like a subtle violence that we do to ourselves. Like, without learning how to deal with that through a healthy habit or a healthy coping mechanism, we end up creating violence to our own emotional and mental selves. That brings us down. And this is just a sort of an example that correlates to dealing with pain. Because whether it be emotional pain or physical pain, we still have to deal with them all the same way, which is learning how to sit with it and learning about it. And often, without training, unless we're particularly evolved at birth or through personal experience, we tend to avoid pain. Like, much of life is the reproduction of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And a lot of what we have in meditation practices, whether it be Buddhist practice, yoga practice, Tibetan practice, Japanese Zen practice, revolves around people that decided to sit with pain instead of avoid pain. In fact, a lot of the Tibetan meditation practices are, I would say, mild forms of torture. I mean, because physical torture. I mean, they do all kinds of crazy stuff to themselves, to induce pain, to challenge their capacity to not, or to understand it, or to challenge their capacity to not go into the pain, but to sit with it without letting it become them. Does that make sense? And one of the weird questions that I always have is, you know how the Tibetans in particular are very into, I'm not saying that they're into it, but one of their highest forms of non-violent resistance is putting themselves on fire. And we've all seen that, right? I mean, we've heard of it or we've seen something like it. And the people that do that actually train a lot of their lives to actually be able to do that with a meditative state of mind. I mean, to us, it looks like sheer pain, and it probably is. But these Tibetan monks have trained to deal with that kind of pain. Like, if they're going to set themselves on fire as a way of making a statement, they're usually not someone that just does it. They're someone that's been training to do it for a long time. Does that make sense? And so in our own way, we have to do something very similar, which is, and when you're sitting, when you're in your head meditating, what we end up doing is, for the most part, doing the opposite of what we should be doing, which is we tend to avoid, we tend to try to categorize and put pain in its place, instead of kind of going into it and being in that shaky but present state. Because when you get closer to where you are, and this is the nature of fear, is, you know, when you get closer to your fear, we get shaky and you know, and we start getting nervous. Whether it be on a subtle level or an obvious level, when you're confronting someone that you're afraid of, you shake physically and you get nervous. But when you confront yourself internally, you also do a similar thing, but it's just a different level. And learning how to be in that place is what fearlessness is. Ultimately, you know, fearlessness is not going into combat more doggedly and with more armor on. It's being able to face whatever it is that you're afraid of and taking your armor off and being able, and that's what courage is. And the more you can recognize that there's nothing to be afraid of in that place, then the more you're capable of really dissolving pain. But to begin that, we have to have a firm foundation of, and this takes time, making the distinction between mind and consciousness, and then also, and then body as well, because body is obviously what we have to work with. Without the body, we just disperse and go on to something else. But since we're in the body, it's our mechanism. It's our, you know, it is our, it's our seat. It's where we sit to meditate. So, and citta, which is what we call consciousness in yoga, is different from mind or manas. And what we have to do in the initial stages of meditation is at least make the start working towards making the distinction between consciousness and mind. The mind is the way station for the senses. All right, we take things in from the external world or from our own sense or from the peripheral of our own senses, and then we digest them through our mind. We filter them through how things should or shouldn't be, and that's where we start getting into duality. That's the black and white world, is we take things into the senses, and based on our experiences, we filter them through, and then it comes out as this altered version of reality. Does that make sense? It should make sense. I mean, we all do this on varying levels, and for our own social status and status in our house and friends and family, we have to maintain a certain level of ego, but when we meditate, we're trying to dismantle this identity that we have around ourselves or around things and sensations so that we can at some point maybe take in reality unadulterated through the mind. So what we have to do is recognize that we're already it. You know, whatever we are trying to achieve in meditation, we're already it. Like, I am God, sort of thing. Being still, you already are where you need to be. The problem is that we have to take down some of our armor to experience who we already are. You with me? And that taking down of the armor requires fearlessness. It requires facing some of the things that we are afraid of, because that armor has given us a shield or a wall against the unveiling of maybe some truth about ourselves. All right, so when we sit, the first thing we have to recognize is that we're already there. All we have to do is start being curious about who we are and less fearful about who we are. fear is totally normal. And what you have to do when you start getting into your head in these meditations is recognizing that when you get into the fear, when you start getting a little nervous, that's good. That's a good thing. We tend to react to it like it's a bad thing. And the way that I like to define that or describe that as an analogy is, you know, if you think about a kid who's restless and you try to make him sit still for 5 minutes, you go, sit still for a second, they'll probably be okay for like 5 minutes. But then they're going to catch on to your game because you intend to make them sit for 2 hours. But after about 5 minutes, they're going to say, wait a second, I don't like sitting still. And then your job is going to be a lot harder. Once that first 5 minutes, that sweet spot when you get 5 minutes, because if you're a parent and you got 5 minutes of quietness is like 10 hours of quietness. Normal people don't realize what it's like to have kids that are just crazy all the time. But you take that 5 minutes, just closing the door and walking around to the other side of the car is like a vacation, you know? But if you have a kid that sits still for 5 minutes, those first five minutes are beautiful. And it's the same thing with meditation. In the initial meditation, you're like, finally, some calmness. You know, you've shut everything out and you're quiet. And just that quietness all by itself is beautiful. But then the work starts to happen. Your mind starts to become restless. And you're going to have to use different approaches to romance it back to a place of stillness. And then in that attempt at romancing the stillness, you start to learn about the nature of that child or your mind. Its nature is to attach to food or attach to money or attach to love affairs. You know, your mind tends to go to these places for, you don't even have to ask yourself, why do they go there? What you have to recognize is that they go there and sitting with it to dissolve it. A lot of times just sitting there, you know, you go to this place where you're afraid of money. And if you just sit with it and let your heart melt, the whole thing dissolves. It's not even, you don't even have to psychoanalyze yourself. You can just let yourself soften up to it. And then you realize, I don't even know why I was making that up about money. Or you might realize, yeah, I do have some issues with money. I need to be proactive, you know, get my finances under control. But something is to be learned there. So when you sit and meditate, realize that you have to know that you're already there. But what you have to do is tame that child. That kid is going to get bored in 5 minutes. And so what we do, we say, just sit still and be a good boy or girl. Sit still. And I'll be back in 5 minutes. And if you do that, there's going to be a reward. And we give ourselves his own reward. And then maybe you go 6 minutes, because the kid's going to count every 5 minutes. When you meditate and you go, I got 5 minutes, about 4 minutes into it, you're thinking, I bet it's about 5 minutes. It's 4 minutes. And you're counting the minutes. And that kid knows when 6 minutes is up. 5 minutes is a long time to him. So then what you have to do is you have to give it something to do, which is the breath. So we give that kid, we say, well, just count the breaths for about 5 more minutes, and then I'll give you another treat. And so the breath becomes like a tether for the mind. You know, its attention starts to wander off. You go, no, watch that breath. And then it starts looking over here at what Sally's doing, because Sally is playing with blocks, and it's a lot more interesting. And you go, no, just stay with the breath, and you'll get that candy, I promise. And your candy, ultimately, is recognizing the distinction between consciousness and mind. Mind is still a part of the senses. It's not who we are. We think it's who we are. The contents of what's up in here, we tend to think that that's me. I have a red car. I have a house. I have a dog. I have a wife. I think, I am this car. I am this house. I am this... You know, you don't say that to yourself, but you very much identify with things. And what we have to do is recognize that's just concepts in our head, and there's a difference between stuff and spark of intelligence, your sense of creative desire in the world, your ability to get out and want to do something spiritually creative, etc. Does that make sense? Okay, so when you meditate, your ground state should be, I'm already here. Let's just start being curious about the chinks in this armor. Right, and that's where we start getting into pain. And to me, that's kind of a little bit like what that God is. You're already there with it. You know, it's not apart from you. It's there. What we have to do is become naked. You know, we have to take down our armor and recognize the fearlessness in being with truth, being who we truly are, unadulterated by concepts of who we are or things. With me? I'll take that as a collective yes. And I can't wait. I'll take it as a collective yes. And I can't wait to meditate more. All right, so let's go ahead and what we're going to do, I'm going to use the physical body, just like I did last week. And I'm going to talk you through the physical actions. There's a lot of ways to do a meditation. I'll talk you through the physical actions. And what I want you to do is try not to think of the physical actions as means towards perfection. They're just means towards keeping you present. So you're going to get some instruction on internalizing, withdrawing from the senses, but at the same time, I'm going to say something about your hips or your thighs or your chest or your ribs or your something. And all those things are meant to kind of make you find a balance between being physically present and going away mentally. Going away too much makes us dull. Our consciousness becomes dull. You start getting lost. And then we use the physical body to keep the chitta or the consciousness alert. Does that make sense? If we do too much physical body, if we just sit here and just focus on being physically alert the whole time, then we have no mind. It's all just physicality. So we have to find a balance between the two, using the physical actions themselves, like the breath, as a tether for the tendency for the mind to wander. Okay, you ready? Okay, so sit tall. On a basic level, you just think energy up through the spine. You don't even have to think about all the particulars. You just think energy up through the spine. Now, go ahead and just close the eyes and level the chin. And the first place you want to start, or a good place to start, is in the root or the base of your posture. So the sitting bones, the hips, the buttocks, wherever you feel the pressure and where you're sitting, that's where you want to start. And specifically, you want to press down through them. Now, there's a difference between sitting and pressing down through your root. So you want to press down through, and when you press down through your two contact points, whether they be the buttocks or the sitting bones or the hips, whatever you're feeling, the backs of the thighs, you want to feel that pressure down gives you vertical lift up. So you want to connect the pressing down through the root as a means for lifting the spine. Now, when you create that action, the idea is to sustain it. So don't do it hard. Press down through the sitting bones or the buttocks in a way that it makes you feel alert with what your hips are doing, but try not to make your hips hardened by the action. Because if we do it too hard, you know, we'll inevitably start to lose it. So we want a mild, comfortable, sustained effort through the hips. And then the spine lifts from the grounding down through the hips. And then what I want you to do is I want you to, and this may be for some of us a more of a concept than actuality, but it does turn into reality the more you practice it, is that I want you to try to spread your back ribs. And the back ribs, I'm talking about the space right above the lower back. So the fleshy part of the lower back, the left and the right, try to let those lower back ribs spread. And then lift those back ribs up. So those lower back ribs should spread and then lift. And if you get some kind of sensation between those ribs, like almost like a cramp or something like that, that's a good thing. You want to, because those muscles do stretch if you focus on it properly. And if you need some assistance, you can breathe into that space. So you can inhale into the back ribs, and sometimes just the inhalation alone allows for the expansion. But then the challenge comes in, once you have that space, trying not to deflate it on the exhalations. So again, we have our pressure down to the sitting bones, or the hips, the backs of legs, whatever you're grounded in. The back ribs, the lower back ribs spreading and then lifting. So we create space around the kidneys. Now, the third instruction is I want you to take the shoulder heads, or the shoulders, straight back. So you just broaden across the collarbones a little bit. And just that all by itself should give you a sense of opening in the chest or the heart. And this is important because when we meditate, you want to keep the heart open, at least for the sense of keeping uplift in your chest. When the chest starts to collapse, then the psychology internally starts to go into darkness. We want to keep the chest lifted. We want to keep the heart bright, just for the physical statement of positivity. So shoulders back, and then the shoulder blades descend. And when you take the shoulder blades down the back, you might come to a point in the mid/upper back that feels like it's contracting a little bit. And that should be what helps to lift your chest. And that point becomes the sort of pedestal for your chest. So if you move that space in, that should be what lifts the breastbone. And then let's go back through it. So we press down through the hips to lift the spine. We spread the lower back ribs and lift those back ribs up simultaneously. That should give us a sense of lift up out of the lower back and out of the hips. And then we take the shoulders straight back and then down. That by itself should stretch the chest. But then if you're paying attention to what's happening in the middle upper back, that should give you a little bit of lift to the sternum as well. And then what I want you to do is I want you to cycle through these internally to yourself for about a minute. And get them to a point where you feel that you're stable, steady, alert, but not rigid. So if anything is hyperactive, then dissolve it, let it relax a little bit. If anything seems dull, if you're not aware of your hips at all, try to put a little bit more energy there. But again, the overall energy, even if you're not thinking about particulars, is that you're maintaining a general sense of lift so that you're not falling down in your pose, but that you're lifting up out of your hips, out of your root. You can do this for about a minute now. Alert, but not rigid. Chest is lifted. Back ribs are lifted. Chin is level. Focusing on the physical. And now that you have the alertness of your posture, I want you to check in with the senses. So the most obvious places are the jaw and the eyes. And notice that if by concentrating on the posture, we started to harden the senses. So soften the eyes, soften the jaw, soften the tongue. And if you can make an attempt at it, you can also try to soften the skin without losing the posture. Now what I want you to do is we're going to withdraw the senses a bit more, but from time to time, and I may remind you or I may not, I want you to check back in with your posture. And when you do, try not to jolt yourself back to your posture. A lot of times when we go from the mental to the physical, we jolt. I want you to try to sort of ease back into the awareness of, is my chest lifted? Are my hips active? Are my back ribs lifting? Are my shoulders back? But now with the eyes soft, the jaw relaxed, the tongue soft, the skin soft, I want you to take your awareness to the breath. Just observe its inherent rhythm. Unmodified observation of the breath. Let the belly be soft. Let the breath breathe itself. Again, try not to have any direction for the breath. This can be quite challenging at first, learning how to let the breath just do its own thing. As the breath begins to take on its own natural rhythm, try to pay attention to that tempo or that rhythm. You could add numbers to it, so maybe the inhalation comes in for a two count, and then the exhalation goes out for one or two. Again, try not to modify it, just observe it. Back to the physical actions, pressing down through the hips, lifting the spine, again, either particular or general sense of uplift. Come back to the breath. Again, observe its inherent rhythm, unmodified observation of the breath. Giving it qualities based on your observation, so if it has a two count in, a one count out, just recognize that and be familiar with it. And then if you have a particular count that you've been noticing, what we're going to do now is start to elongate the count. And the first thing that we have to do is establish a symmetrical breath or a parallel breath. So if the exhalation was shorter, we have to make the exhalation longer now. The inhalation was short, we make it longer, so that we have a symmetrical breath. So if we have a two count in, we have a two count out. If we have a three count in, we have a three count out. Try not to think of a longer breath as being more successful, because it's not. What we're looking for is symmetry. So this is a guided breath now, but we're modifying the inherent rhythm to make it symmetrical. Now see if you can simultaneously create symmetry in your breath while maintaining the alertness of the physical body. To keep, if nothing else, the uplift of the spine while maintaining that parallel breath. Now sometimes when you create this parallel breath and the physical posture at the same time, you might experience some level of anxiety. Which is really just a little bit of pressure on the solar plexus. So if you do feel like you're getting a little bit anxious from the posture, let the breathing go and take a couple of normal deep breaths. Just normal, deep, you know, cleansing breaths. Just to, you know, disperse any anxiety that's being produced. You may or may not have that, but just know that it's perfectly fine to disperse it through some normal deep cleansing breaths. Once you've noticed that the nerves have become settled, and the heart rate is back to normal, then we get back to that parallel breath. Now the next stage of breathing that we're going to do is called Ujjayi breath, which is really just an extension of the exhalation and a slight pause on the exhalation. So what I want you to do is continue recognizing that parallel breath. Stay in tune with that parallel breath. Again, do a brief scan of the physical body. And then similarly, as I mentioned, when we're preparing the posture, with every successive inhalation, I want you to get those back ribs lifted up a little bit more and more. And with the exhalations, try not to deflate that lift. Still maintaining a parallel breath, into two, out to two, or into three, out to three, whatever your rhythm is. Now what you're going to do is you're going to take that exhalation and you're going to extend it for maybe a count or two beyond. So you might have a two in and a four out, or a two in and a three out. But be content with one particular rhythm. Don't think that more is better. Just if you're going to do three, stick with three. Just take this time to familiarize yourself with your rhythm. And then what we're going to do beyond this is we're going to actually create a little bit of a pause on the exhalation. So at the end of the exhalation, you're going to hold the breath. So you're not really holding anything in or out. You're just creating a dramatic pause. And then you want to slowly allow the inhalations to come back in. And when you do that, again, as you go down to the bottom of the exhalation, there's just a lull. There's not a holding. There's not a tension in the abdomen or the chest. You just come to sort of a soft pause. And then you let the inhalation come in naturally. Soft and natural. If you hold the breath too hard, then the breath comes in as a big sucking wind. Then you know that you're forcing too hard on the exhalations. You want to exhale, pause, and allow that inhalation to come in soft and smooth. The transition from the inhalation to the exhalation should be seamless. There should be no jerk or pause from the inhalation to the exhalation. Just come back to a normal breathing rhythm. Come back to symmetrical. So if you had two before and two out before, go back to that. Back to allowing the breath to just breathe itself. Alert the physical posture, pressing down through the hips, lift the back ribs, lift the chest. Quiet the eyes. And now just to be a little bit more specific about the sense withdrawal, I want you to quiet the eyes and take the gaze to the back of the brain. not so much the eyeball gaze, but the inward gaze to the back of the brain, where the consciousness is quieter and more reflective. And from that place, observe the breath. And just listen to that ocean-like sound. Be willing to be fully in the breath. Feel the skin expanding. Feel the chest rising and falling. Be fully immersed in the sound of the breath. Allow yourself to envelop yourself in the breath with all of your senses. More breaths here. Well, the first thing that happens when we start thinking about coming out of our pratyahara or meditation is we start thinking about what are we going to do next, and the idea is to create a lasting impression on your state of mind. So whatever stillness that you create, quietness, internal stillness, recognition of the rhythm of the breath, whatever you've noticed internally, the idea is to allow it to have a lasting impression. So try not to jump out of the senses. As you start rousing yourself back to your senses, try not to project through the eyes or go out through the ears. You want to maintain contact with, whether it be the breath or perhaps the posture or just the general sense of stillness internally. Okay. All right, and then on your own time, you can open your eyes. So that's, again, using posture with a little bit of pranayama or breathing exercise, that is considered one of the ujjayi breaths. There's five or so, and particularly we did a little bit of rishaka, which basically means retention. You can do a retention on the inhalation, and you can also do it on the exhalation. And then in my experience and from some of my Taoist practice in doing Tai Chi and Qigong and all that stuff, is that the exhalations are meant, doing retention on the exhalation, at least theoretically, is meant to teach you how to develop more mental prowess in your meditation. Whereas retention on the inhalation is meant to give you more physical energy. So that's a really broad way of putting it. There's a lot of derivations of that. So I would encourage you to, on your own time, kind of flirt with retention on the exhalation, retention on the inhalation, and see what it feels like to you. And let me tell you, you don't just get it immediately. Do it for like a week or two. Do exhalations for a solid week or two, and then see how that makes you feel. Maybe it makes you feel physically colder. Maybe it makes you feel more mentally introspective. It can make you feel more emotional. I mean, there's a lot of things. Nothing is negative. It's just, how does it make you feel? And then the next 2 weeks, do retention on the inhalation and see how that makes you feel. Maybe you've got more energy. Maybe you want to, you know, do stuff around the house or read a book, or, you know, you just look at the changes between the two types of energy on the exhalation and the inhalation. Again, these are real broad introductions to some breathing practices. I use the yoga way of getting into it, but in the Taoist way of looking at it, these are considered the yin and yang, the introduction to yin and yang breathing. And then hopefully over time, as we get to know one another, I'll talk to you a little bit more specifically about the energy, how to start directing your energy, the energy that you get from these particular practices, you try to direct it in a particular way. And that, if we get to that point, that's where it's, I think, you might, depending on your level of practice, you might actually, that might be the most useful thing in terms of dealing with pain. But for now, we've got just the sense withdrawal, which, if you heard me say pratyahara, which basically means sense withdrawal, withdrawing from the external, but maintaining contact with the external through physical posture.
This was simply magnificent, but what I'm wanting is all that you said in a tape form.
Oh, yeah. You want a something you can sit down with and meditate with.
The one comment I will make, though it's not the same, you have your guided meditations that you can simply use some of these details in practice to apply. And as Robert mentioned, I would recommend taking one piece of it and working with that for a while, so that, you know, even though we want to grasp all of this and include all of it, and there's that tendency to want to make it right and perfect and just get all of it in terms of improving our practice, you may be able to benefit from taking one piece and consistently practicing it rather than trying to balance and struggle with doing everything at once.
But there is, it's not a bad idea. I would say I could maybe come up with a...
Careful what you ask.
I know, I'm not going to promise.
I mean, look, I'll buy it.
I would just get it. But I'm just saying, I understand, you know, what I take from that, having done yoga and kung fu and martial arts and tai chi and all stuff, is that it's good to have a foundation to work from. And I know it seems kind of like in yoga, there's always, like, I do standing when I practice poses. I do standing poses a lot because they're the foundation for everything else you do. Whether you stand on your head or you do seated poses or you do whatever, you always have to do your standing poses. Even if you become really proficient at doing other stuff, you always have to go back and train the basics, because if you stay away from them too long, they will still start to become dull, right? And there's a lot of stuff that I teach at my kung fu school that I learned the first day I came in to train, and I still do it every day. Even though I think, physically I feel like this is boring, I still do it, because it's a good ground, and if your ground is strong, you're always going to do. So I would, if I did something, I would do something like a strong meditation, like a strong foundation meditation thing that you can always branch off from into other things. So if I do it, which I'm not promising, I'll give you something like that. And I think that's what you want, is something that's, yeah. Anyone else have any questions or anything that you...
Yeah, thriving once again. Giving us another tool to work with and work from, and I'm going to utilize that for the next 4 weeks, just that one practice, you know, because being in your background of like with martial arts, it kind of takes me back to like Bruce Lee. And really, I mean,